I would like to dedicate this shir, Lezichar Nishmas, my grandfather, Rabbi Cheskel Yehoshua ben Harav Avraham Yitzchak, Mr. Joshua Avson, and much of this shir was put together on the day of his yahrzeit, Beis Nisan. As we begin Letter 18, Part 2, we'll just quickly recap the very end of Letter 18, Part 1, which was Rav Hirsch's criticism of Rambam. So continuing, as a result, other men who had a more profound grasp of Judaism came to oppose this philosophical attitude. So let's just pause for a second. When Rav Hirsch says here, a more profound grasp, we will turn to Rabbi Elias's note number 7, and he writes, although the author does not agree with those who became opponents of the pursuit of philosophy, he credits them with a more profound grasp of Judaism than those mentioned in the previous paragraph who presume themselves possessors of the ideas represented by the mitzvos. The latter saw little need to study or practice mitzvos, yet the ideas which they had developed as a result of their philosophical inquiries were at total variance with Torah tradition and laws. So again, other men who had a more profound grasp of Judaism came to oppose this philosophical attitude and in due course became opponents of intellectual inquiry in general and of the pursuit of philosophy in particular. Now, the opposite school of thought began to reject all philosophical speculation of any type, and this is also an extremely dangerous position, as Rav Hirsch is about to explain. Now, to an extent, I would say that the yeshiva world suffers from this, where, depending on the yeshiva you're in, intellectual inquiry is not something which is necessarily encouraged. Certainly, philosophy on any level is not encouraged. And some might say that the word hashkafa is akin or related to philosophy, but most people that are in yeshiva, at least that I've met, would really look askance at comparing hashkafa and philosophy together. It really does depend how you use the word. Anyway, certain misunderstood expressions were used as weapons with which to repel any effort to elucidate the inner meaning of Talmudic teachings. Now, in order to show that there were expressions that were used to repel any efforts to elucidate any Talmudic teachings, Rav Hirsch quotes two midrashim, and we'll see one of them inside. So let us see Bereishis Rabbah 44:1. And when we learned the piece from Mor Nevuchim about mitzvos, we actually quoted this. It says, Rav Amar, lo nitnu ha-mitzvos, elo litzarif bahenes habrios. Mitzvos were only given to test people. V'chima ichbas leila ha-kodesh baruch hu l'misha shochit min ha-tzavar, o misha shochit min ha-oref. What does God care if I slaughter an animal from the front of its neck or from the nape of its neck? Heve lo nasnu ha-mitzvos, elo litzarif bahenes habrios. So we see from here that mitzvos were only given to test man. Now, Rav Hirsch in the footnote, he writes as follows. He writes, the injunction against Darshinan Taima Dikra, which has often been held up to me, has no meaning other than the very correct one that in practical decisions we should not attach any importance to the assumed reason for a mitzvah, since it is only conjecture. So Rav Hirsch rejects Darshinan Taima Dikra as a source for not being allowed to give reasons for mitzvos. He says that can't be. It's only when it comes to halacha lemaisa, that we don't attach importance to any of the reasons for mitzvos, since it's all conjecture anyway. And in order to prove this, Rav Hirsch now quotes the Ramban from Vayikra 19:19, where Rav Hirsch uses this as an assertion that it's okay to expound on mitzvos as long as it does not affect halacha. So Ramban starts by quoting Rashi, Es chukosai tishmur, you shall keep my chukim. So Rashi says, Ve'ilu hein, behem techo lu sarbia kilayim, you should not do kilayim with your animals, etc. Chukim, elu gzeros melech she'in tam ledavar. Rashi says that chukim are decrees of the king that have no reason. So Ramban says, Ve'lo hizkiru rabosinu, she'ia hatam ne'alam. We don't find by our Rabbanon that there are no reasons for mitzvos, or that the reasons are hidden. With the exception of the mitzvah of shatnez, not by this mitzvah, by klaim of an animal, it does have a reason, as we're going to explain. Ve'ein ha'kavona bahem shetiya gzeras melech malchei amlachim b'shem makom below tam. Our Rabban never meant that there are no reasons for mitzvos. He called imras elokat sirufa, because every word of God is tested. And now Ramban gives a mashal. He says, rak ha'chukim him gzeras hamelech. The chukim are like decrees of a king. Asher yichok b'malchuso b'lisha yigalit to'alasam la'am. You have a king who just commands, he gives laws, without explaining the purpose to his nation. Ve'in ha'am ne'anim bahem, and the people, they don't get it, they don't understand it. Avol meharharin acharehem b'libon. But in their hearts, they question it, they think about it. U'mekavim nosan liyiras ha'malchus. Yet, nevertheless, they accept these laws out of fear of the government. So Ramban now says, v'chein chukei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The same is true for God's chukim. Heim hasodos asher lo b'torah. They are secrets of the Torah. She'en ha'am b'machashavasam ne'anim bahem kimishpatim. That the reasons for these are not as apparent as the reasons of the mishpatim that are more apparent. Avo kulam b'tam nachon. V'to'eles shalema, but they all have a good and proper reason. So that's enough for us from the Ramban for right now. Ramban is clear that just about every mitzvah, with maybe the exception of shatneys, which are abundant apparently, do not offer a reason for. All the other mitzvos, there are reasons that are given for them. And we have the right to give such reasons as long as it does not affect the practical halacha in any way. Continuing, moreover, no distinction was made in this connection between the questions, what is stated here, and why is it stated? Thus, not even the category of Eidos, which by their very nature are meant to convey intellectual insights, was excluded from this ban on intellectual inquiry. So let's see what Rav Hirsch means when he writes that no distinction was made between what is stated and why is it stated. So this comes from Rabbi Elias, footnote number 9, and he writes, Rav Hirsch is saying that even if, in general, we should not ask why a mitzvah has to be done, since it is a divine commandment, we do have to ask what the mitzvah is. And in the case of many mitzvos, notably the Eidos, attention to the reasons for the mitzvah is indeed part of its proper observance. Regarding some Eidos, the Torah itself wants us to be aware of the reason. Thus, the Torah says that we should dwell in Sukkos, so that your generations will know that I have made the children of Yisrael dwell in Sukkos. The Bach and others conclude that when the Torah spells out the reason for a mitzvah, we have to keep it in mind when doing the mitzvah. Rav Hirsch argues that since all Eidos are meant to convey basic Torah teachings, even those opposed to inquiry into Tamei HaMitzvos should accept it in the case of these mitzvos. Okay, so now we're going to move on to a slightly different topic. Another misunderstood passage in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, we're going to look up in a moment, later led even to a rejection of the study of Tanakh, an error about which we have been specifically, almost prophetically forewarned from Maseches Sofrim, which we're going to look up in a moment as well. As a result, when oppression and persecution robbed Yisrael of the fresh and living contact with world and life, in other words, we were very sheltered, and when the Talmud had yielded almost all of its teachings for practical life, the intellect and its desire for activity inevitably went astray and occupied itself with dialectic subtleties. And dialectics are logical arguments. And this is a reference to the method of learning known as Pilpul, which Rav Hirsch was against, as were many others as well. And this fits in well with Rav Hirsch's understanding of Torah Lishma, that the Torah should provide guidance to correct action rather than being an end in and of itself, as Rabbi Elias writes. So before we get back to our discussion whether Tanakh should be studied or should not be studied, since we already mentioned Pilpul, let us see what Rav Hirsch writes about Pilpul. And the following comes from a letter Rav Hirsch wrote to his friend, Z.H. May, and this could be found in the introduction to Chorev, and we'll see what Dan Grunfeld says on this. The weakest feature in Yisrael's present parlous condition is in respect of Jewish scholarship, the way in which Bible, Talmud, and Midrash have been studied for the last 100 years. We are now paying dearly for this mistaken method of Torah study, because life has long since been banished from the study of the Torah. The Torah has been banished from life. And the following is Daniel Grunfeld's note on this paragraph. As can be seen from the 19 letters, Rav Hirsch refers here to the excessive application of the dialectical method in the study of the Talmud, known as Pilpul or Chiluk. This system of study was elaborated by Rav Yaakov Palek. No legal thinking, least of all Talmudical thinking, can entirely dispense with the dialectical method, provided it is compatible with clear and plain logical reasoning. As long as the system of Pilpul keeps within these natural limits, it fulfills a useful purpose in Talmudical training. As soon, however, as it becomes mere logic chopping and indulges in dialectics for dialectics' sake, without proper consideration for sane reasoning, the true meaning of the Talmudical text, pshat, and above all the demands of practical halacha, it presents a danger to Jewish thought and life. This is what Rav Hirsch intended to point out in the above passage, on which he elaborated more fully in his 19 letters. Nor was Rav Hirsch the only figure in Jewish literary history to utter a warning against this danger of exaggerated dialectics in the study of Talmud. Thus, Yeshaya Horowitz, the famous Talmudist and Kabbalist, author of Shnei Luchos Habris, Shelah, opposed in that work the excessive application of the Pilpulistic method. So did Maharal in his work Tiferes Yisrael and Nesivos Olam. The same attitude was taken by the Gaon of Vilna and his disciple and collaborator Reb Chaim of Vilozhin, who is known in Jewish history as the founder of the famous yeshiva bearing his name. These great men and their disciples, while zealously preserving and deepening the characteristic method of Talmudical thinking, rejected the exaggerated Pilpulistic method in favor of sound and sane reasoning. In addition to handing down the traditional halacha unimpaired, the aim of classical Talmudical thinking has always been to elucidate the fundamental halachic conceptions and to demonstrate the inner connection and inseparable unity of the written and oral law. For this aim, conceptual thinking is at least as important as, if not more important than, dialectical thinking. This view, indicated in the present letter, was often stressed by Rav Hirsch in his later writings, and was practically demonstrated in his famous commentary on the Torah. In that commentary, there appears before our eyes the inseparable unity of written and oral law as expounded in the halachic or Tanaic Midrashim, Mechilta, Sifra, and Sifrei, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Babylonian and Palestinian Talmud, and generally in the corpus of our halachic and midrashic literature. And we are shown how the entire spiritual and legal edifice of the Jewish Weltanschauung and the Jewish way of life in its grand design and ethical purity arises out of the text of the written law, inseparably joined to the vast body of oral law by means of hermeneutical rules of halachic interpretations known as the Midos Shehatorah Nidreshes Bahem. And if anyone wants to see more on this, if you look at Diane Grunfeld's introduction to the Hirsch Chumash, which could be found at the very beginning of Bereshis in the Levi edition, he goes at length to explain this connection between the written and the oral law. So let's return to Rav Hirsch's study of whether Tanakh should be learned or not. And he writes that another misunderstood passage, which is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, specifically quoting Tosfos, led to a rejection of the study of Tanakh. So Rabbeinu Tam writes that our Talmud, meaning Talmud Bavli, is a mixture of Mikra and Mishnah and Gemara, obviously, and therefore we are potur ourselves from what our Chachamim say, La'olam yishalish adam shenosav shlish b'mikra, shlish b'mishnah, shlish b'shas. So Rav Hirsch is saying that this Tosfos, based on Rabbeinu Tam, was taken and was understood to mean that a person does not need to learn Tanakh. And Tosfos just finishes off, interestingly, he says, Afal pi kein, even though we do not involve ourselves in the study of Tanakh, Anu korim b'chol yom parshas HaTamid. Every morning when we say after Birchas HaShachar, we say Korbanos, we say the parshas HaTamid. V'shonim b'mishna izeu mekoman. V'gorsin Rabbi Shmuel Omer b'shlosh esrei midos, which will be specifically learning Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. So therefore, even if a person would be involved in Gemara all day, meaning in Shas Bavli, nevertheless, by learning these three things, he is still fulfilling what the Chachamim said, that La'olam Yishalish Adam Shinosav Shlish B'Mikra, Shlish B'Mishnah, and Shlish B'Shas. Now Rav Hirsch holds that this Tosfos is misunderstood. And Tosfos never meant that we should reject the study of Tanakh. And he says we were specifically and almost prophetically forewarned about this in Maseches Sofrim. So let's see that inside. Perek Tes Vav, Halacha Tes. We'll actually start from Ches. Ve'od, Nimshala HaTorah Kimelach. The Torah is comparable to salt. V'hamishnah kipilpilin, like pepper. V'hashas kibisamim. V'efshar la'olam b'lo melach. The world cannot exist without salt. V'efshar la'olam b'lo pilpilin, and can't exist without pepper. V'efshar la'olam b'lo besamim. V'ish ashir, mischalkel b'shlashton. A rich person will satisfy himself with all three of these things. So the Gemara says, kach v'efshar la'olam b'lo mikra, v'efshar la'olam b'lo mishna, v'efshar la'olam b'lo hashas. The world cannot exist without these three basic things. Mikra, Mishnah, and Shas. Now, going into Halacha Tes, Aval Ashrei Adam, Sheish Amalo B'Hashas. However, what's the Iker? The Iker is a person should focus on Gemara. V'lo sheyehei doleg b'mikra uv'mishnah v'yavo l'hashas. You should not skip learning Tanakh and Mishnayos in order to come to Shas. Al menas sheilamid mikra uv'mishnah v'yavo l'hashas. Rather, a person must first learn these things, and then he can come to Gemara itself. So let's see Rabbi Elias in note number 10. The Tosfos referred to here comments on the Talmudic statement that the Babylonian Talmud contains in it Tanakh, Mishnah, and Gemara. The Tosfos explains that in studying Talmud, we therefore discharge the obligation to study these three, although in practice every morning we are instructed to recite passages from all three concerning the sacrifices. Rav Hirsch points out that it is a misunderstanding of this Tosfos to conclude that Tanakh is not deserving of study by itself, and he refers to the passage in Tractate Sofrim that warns against such a view. Hail to the man who puts his effort into Talmud study. However, he should not skip over Tanakh and Mishnah in order to come to the Talmud, but study Tanakh and Mishnah and then come to the Talmud. We should also note that according to Rashi in Shemos 31:18, a Talmud Chacham must be familiar with the 24 books of the Tanakh. And then in the rest of the note, Rabbi Elias goes through other reasons why Tanakh may have been either neglected or rejected. But we could say clearly that according to Rav Hirsch, a person must study Tanakh, and when a person studies Gemara itself, he must not delve into pilpilistic methodologies of learning Gemara. Continuing, during this whole period, only very few stood with their intellectual investigations completely within Judaism and built the interpretation of Judaism entirely upon its own premises. Among these, the author of the Kuzari and the Ramban excelled. Generally, an uncomprehended Judaism ruled. So before we continue, let us see what Rav Hirsch means by this uncomprehended Judaism in footnote number 12. And Rabbi Elias writes that Rav Hirsch is referring to the general aversion to philosophical inquiry among German Jewry during the Middle Ages. In contrast to North African and Spanish Jewry, German Jewish life was essentially turned inward, devoted to the ethical and sometimes mystical pietism that is represented by the Hasidei Ashkenaz, such as Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid and the Rokeach Rav Elazar of Worms. This was a result not only of the repression German Jews suffered, to which the author refers, but also to the fact that there was no need to develop a response to the surrounding culture. Medieval Germany did not offer any philosophical challenge to the Jew, as did Spain. Apparently, Rav Hirsch considered the lack of deeper thought about the spirit of Judaism to be a weakness of German Jewry. But here he stresses its rock-solid commitment to the fundamental principles of Torah and its willingness to die for them. In contrast, we find in his essays that he is critical of Spanish Jewry, quoting the Chassid Yaivitz's essay Or HaChaim on why so many Spanish Jews found it possible to accept conversion and Murano existence. So again, generally, an uncomprehended Judaism ruled, especially in Germany, where periods of repression and persecution suppressed any free surge of the intellect. However, the general fundamental conviction that God is the one alone, and that the Torah is his will to be fulfilled out of awe and love of God and faith in him, remained in full force everywhere. For its sake, life and all its possessions and pleasures were gladly sacrificed with magnificent dedication. So even though much of Judaism was not properly understood, at least from a philosophical point of looking into mitzvos, the conviction of Hashem and his Torah was so real and so complete to these Jews in Germany that when the Crusades and other persecutions presented themselves, the majority of Jews allowed themselves to be killed for the sake of heaven. In contrast to Spanish Jewry, where that was not as prevalent. As Rabbi Wein likes to say, you find that conviction sometimes is a mile wide, but only an inch deep. We also know that your philosophy has to be connected to emotion, because if it's completely devoid of emotion, there's very little holding you back. So while the Jews in Germany may have been more mystical, but they had much more of an emotional connection, which they were willing to die for. It's much harder to give up on emotion than it is on pure intellect. We will now get into a discussion of Kabbalah. Presently, a form of learning came into existence about which, not being initiated in it, I dare not venture to express any opinion. However, if I properly understand that which I believe I do comprehend, then it is indeed an invaluable repository of the spirit of the Tanakh and the Talmud, but it was also unfortunately misunderstood. The eternal progressive development which it taught came to be considered a static mechanism, and what was to be understood as inner perception was seen as external dream worlds. As this branch of learning came into being, the mind could turn either to external sharp-witted dialectics in the study of Talmud, mentioned before, or to this new field of study, which appealed to the emotions as well. We know that Kabbalah has great emotional appeal, something that people can't really understand, so that makes it all the more popular, and its mystical side obviously adds to that as well. Had it been correctly comprehended, it might perhaps have imbued practical Judaism with spirituality, but as it was misconstrued, the practice of Judaism was interpreted to be a form of magical, mechanistic manipulation, a means of influencing or resisting theosophic worlds and anti-worlds. So, in other words, people looked at Kabbalah as being a means to perform magical feats and a way to influence the universe in some sort of a spiritual way. And Rav Hirsch says that this is incorrect and a dangerous misinterpretation of Kabbalah. Therefore, Kabbalah has little to offer to the masses. And we could say that Kabbalah has never been the property of the masses and should not be the property of the masses. And I would like to use this opportunity to discuss Rav Hirsch's understanding of Kabbalah, which might also help to make this paragraph a little bit clearer. Now, at this point, it's well known that I'm a big fan of Diane Grunfeld, that he has many lucid explanations of Rav Hirsch and his ideals, and he has an explanation of Kabbalah as well. However, I think when it comes to Kabbalah, it would be worth it to see Reb Shlomo Danziger's understanding of Kabbalah. In my own bias, I think that he has the most accurate understanding of Rav Hirsch's understanding. So if you would like to look up Diane Grunfeld's understanding, you could find it in the introduction to Chorev on page 120. It's entitled Hirsch and the Kabbalah. Now the articles that I have chosen for this is a review of the 19 letters from Rabbi Danziger, and in it he's critical of many things that Rabbi Elias writes, including his interpretation of Kabbalah. Then we will see Rabbi Elias' response and Rabbi Danziger's rejoinder to that response. Now, we're not going to go through the entire articles because they're very long. If anyone would like copies of them, please email me and I will try to send those to you. And just at the outset, it's important for me to say that I don't understand all of these issues, but I still think it's well worthwhile to see the sources inside. So let's start off with an article in Jewish Action. This is summer of 96, and this is entitled Rediscovering the Hirschian Legacy. So let's begin on page 21. Rabbi Danziger writes as follows. There is a discernible tendency in Rabbi Elias's commentary to reinterpret Rav Hirsch in conformity with the concepts of non-Hirschian thinkers whose views are followed in many yeshivos. So now we're going to skip down. An illustration of this tendency is with regard to Rav Hirsch's attitude toward Kabbalah. In letter 18, Rav Hirsch writes, presently, a form of learning came into existence about which, not being initiated in it, I cannot venture to pass judgment, but which, if I comprehend rightly, what I believe I understand is an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud, but which has unfortunately been misunderstood. But what should have been eternal, progressive development was considered a static mechanism, and the inner significance and concept thereof was taken as external dream worlds. Had it been correctly comprehended, practical Judaism might perhaps have been imbued with spirituality. Since it was misconstrued, however, it became thereby a magic mechanism, a means of influencing or resisting theosophic worlds and anti-worlds. This criticism is also voiced in letter 10, in which Rav Hirsch complains that the misinterpretation of Kabbalah reduces its spirit to physical terms, and man's inner and outer endeavors came to be interpreted as mere mechanical, magical, dynamic building of cosmic worlds, thereby often reducing all those activities that were meant to train and give vitality to the human spirit to mere amuletic performances. Rav Hirsch's critical attitude of Kabbalah, or as Diane Grunfeld prefers to term it, this guarded attitude, has, in the interest of ideological correctness, been reinterpreted apologetically by Jacob Rosenheim and Diane Grunfeld, who are followed by Rabbi Elias. This apologia runs as follows. 1. Rav Hirsch does, after all, acknowledge Kabbalah as an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud. 2. We find in Rav Hirsch's writings echoes of and parallels to ideas from Kabbalistic literature. 3. Preparatory notes from Chorev indicate that Rav Hirsch made use of the Zohar. And 4. It is said that his personal sitter contained marginal notes of a Kabbalistic nature. Therefore, the explanation of Rav Hirsch's attitude is, in the words of Diane Grunfeld, that Rav Hirsch was concerned with the ethical side of Jewish symbolism and not its mystical side. His ethical symbolism did not exclude the possibility of a mystical symbolism, which holds that every mitzvah has also a cosmic significance, and that the effect of a commandment observed reaches to the remotest ramifications of the universe. Or in the words of Rabbi Elias on page 155, Rav Hirsch's avoidance of mystical and otherworldly speculation does not, however, indicate a denial of Kabbalistic ideas. His ethical interpretations of the mitzvos and of Judaism in general merely represented emphasis on a different aspect of the Torah's teachings, which complements the Kabbalistic approach rather than contradicting it. Both Rav Hirsch's approach to mitzvos and the Kabbalistic approach stress that all human action produces effects. They differ only in that the Kabbalistic approach emphasizes the effects on the whole universe, whereas the other approach underlines the effect of the doer and his world. A non-apologetic reading of Rav Hirsch's words in letter 18 about Kabbalah will indicate that Rav Hirsch is referring to two opposing rather than complementary approaches, the ethical on the one hand and the mystical extra-mundane on the other. He's not complaining that the ethical does not complement the extra-mundane. His complaint is that the proper understanding of Kabbalah should have been ethical, not extra-mundane. No amount of apologetics can get around the hard fact that Rav Hirsch calls the extra-mundane world of, what is in his opinion, misconstrued Kabbalah, external dream worlds. In the same vein, Rav Hirsch's commentary to Leviticus 7:38 reiterates, they, the Korbanos, are neither a transitory concession to a generation that was still steeped in heathen ideas, such as Rambam says, nor do they form a chapter of Kabbalistic magic mysteries. They are mitzvos, laws like the rest of the Torah. Their meaning and purpose is teaching the way to keep the ideals of the Torah, and a means of help to keep the Torah. To Rav Hirsch, Kabbalah is an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud, in the same sense as the Agada contains that spirit. Both, in his view, are rhetorical and metaphorical works designed to suggest the betterment and spiritual elevation of man as he strives, through his acts, to draw nearer to God. Rav Hirsch, who was opposed to all theological speculations about divinity, mystical as well as philosophical, uses Kabbalah only as midrashic, metaphorical suggestions to man about his duties. He does not use Kabbalah as a theological source of information about divinity. For example, the concept of galus, exile, of the Shechina in classical Kabbalah refers to a disruption in the unity of the extra-mundane realm of Sephirotic divinity, those are the Sephiros, which require the restored unification of Tikkun. Thus, the Kabbalistic formula that precedes the performance of various mitzvos is L'shem Yichud Kodesh Brichu U'Shechinte, for the sake of the unification of the Holy One, blessed be He, with His Shekhinah. Rav Hirsch, however, treats this concept as a midrashic metaphor that refers to man's world. Thus, in Judaism Eternal, Rav Hirsch speaks of the period when the Holy Temple still stood in Jerusalem, the period when the land belonged to the sanctuary and the sanctuary to the land, the time when the Torah reigned supreme, as the ideal time that God's majesty, in other words His Shechina, rested on this temple. Following the destruction of the temple, this ideal was shattered. The Torah went into exile, the unfolding of its spirit in the full blossoming of a blessed and God-inspired political life, Yerushalayim, from Shalem. This fulfillment of its divine destiny was left to the future. It is for this Galus Shechina, this exile of the majesty of God, as our ancestors with true insight called it. It is for this sad disfigurement of the Torah that Jewish tears are shed and Jewish hearts mourn on Tisha B'Av. It is in this midrashic, metaphorical sense that Rav Hirsch considered Kabbalah an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud. It is in this rational manner that Rav Hirsch's writings echo with ideas from and parallels to Kabbalistic literature. This is the kind of use that Rav Hirsch made of the Zohar in his preparatory notes for Chorev. Indeed, you will not find in Chorev any Kabbalistic ideas of a theological nature, any speculations about divinity or the Sephiros. It is therefore clear that the preparatory notes of a Kabbalistic nature were put to use only in the kind of rational concepts we find in Chorev. The same applies to the alleged Kabbalistic marginal notes in Rav Hirsch's personal Siddur. So that's enough for us from this article, because that's what concerns Kabbalah. So let's move on to see what Rabbi Elias's response to this article was. And this article is entitled, Hirschians Debate the True Meaning of Hirsch. So Rabbi Elias writes, but what about misrepresentation of Rav Hirsch's views? Were his positions on Kabbalah and Agados, the examples given by Rabbi Danziger, as much in conflict with what is today generally accepted in the Torah community as the reviewer claims? Or is Rabbi Danziger's intent to show major conflict where it is not warranted, as I believe? Considering Rav Hirsch's courageous independence in addressing his contemporaries in a way to which they could relate, one may be tempted to take the first view, but a careful analysis of what he actually wrote shows differently. Concerning Kabbalah, the 19 letters are very clear. One aspect of Judaism, the actual repository of its spirit, was studied in such an uncomprehending way as to reduce this spirit to physical terms, as man's inner and outer endeavors came to be interpreted as mere mechanical, magical, dynamic building of cosmic worlds, thereby often reducing all those activities to mere preoccupation with amulets. If I properly understand that which I believe I do comprehend, then it is indeed an invaluable repository to the Tanakh and the Talmud, but it was also unfortunately misunderstood. Had it been correctly comprehended, it might perhaps have imbued the practice of Judaism with spirituality. In which way was Kabbalah misunderstood? It deals with the profoundest philosophical and ethical issues facing man. The relationship between God and world, the working of divine providence, and the interaction between God and man. These are questions that, by their very nature, transcend the realm of worldly and mundane. Yet, we have no way to describe and discuss them except in our mundane language. Therein lies a grave danger. Just as we must not, God forbid, take the hand of God in a literal, physical sense, so too the expressions and descriptions used by Kabbalah must not be taken in a literal, mundane way. Yet, this was almost unavoidable when Kabbalah became popularized, hence the restrictions imposed by the rabbis as to who was permitted to study it. Very clearly, this is what Rav Hirsch referred to when he wrote that what was to be understood as inner perception was seen as external dream worlds, to be manipulated by amuletic practices and the magical building of cosmic worlds. There is not the slightest indication that he ever questioned the validity of the essence of Kabbalah, its extra-mundane teachings properly understood, and its interpretation of man's inner and outer endeavors. But this is not Rabbi Danziger's understanding. He puts forth his own idea of what Kabbalah is, which he seeks to read into Rav Hirsch's words. Thus he equates Kabbalah and Agada as merely being both, in his view, rhetorical and metaphorical works. The proper understanding of Kabbalah should have been ethical, not extra-mundane. It is in this midrashic, metaphorical sense that Rav Hirsch considers Kabbalah an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud. Very clearly, Rabbi Danziger excludes here the extra-mundane foundations of Kabbalah. We must ask, which Torah authority of whatever camp has ever put forward this interpretation of Kabbalah? Certainly, Rav Yosef Karo, the Shla, the Vilna Gaon, or the Nefesh HaChaim did not. Nor did the Poskim, who considered Kabbalah, unlike Agada, in their halachic deliberations, from the Ramah down to the Mishnah Berurah, which contains more than 200 references to Kabbalah. Yet, Rabbi Danziger ascribes this view to Rav Hirsch without the slightest shred of evidence. True, Rav Hirsch consistently chose to offer rational, ethical explanations of his work. The reason for this decision of his are discussed at length in my commentary. But nowhere does he indicate that he considers his rationalistic interpretation of the mitzvos as negating Kabbalah rather than as an alternative to it. In fact, Rav Breuer, quoting Rabbi Moshe Fuchs, as saying that anyone who knows Kabbalah will find Kabbalistic ideas throughout Rav Hirsch's Chumash commentary, though clothed in rationalistic terms. Moreover, there are in it actual outright quotations of the Zohar, albeit unattributed, such as Bereishis 2:15. Rabbi Danziger mentions Rav Hirsch's objection to philosophical speculation about God, mystical as well as philosophical. In the first place, his primary objection was to the religious philosophers because their efforts to remove any thought of divine corporeality in the end run very nearly into the danger of losing all idea of the personality of God. And that's from Bereishis 6:6. While he was surely not in favor of philosophizing about the essence of God, there are many passages in Rav Hirsch's writings that speak about God's attributes, closely following Kabbalistic ideas. Example, see Shemos 15:6 about God's right hand and left hand. And there are some other examples listed as well. These are good examples of how the ethical teachings that Rav Hirsch draws from Kabbalah are deeply rooted in its extra-mundane essence. There is indeed one verse in Vayikra 7:38, quoted by Rabbi Danziger, which suggests an outright rejection of Kabbalah. The Korbanos do not form a chapter of Kabbalistic magic mysteries. However, lo and behold, Rav Hirsch never wrote this. The word Kabbalistic was inserted by Dr. Levy in his English translation. The original German text reads, and I'm just going to read it, the translation in English, they do not form by themselves a chapter of thaumaturgic magical mysteries. According to Webster, thaumaturgic means magical miracle workings. All we have here is a repetition of the words which Rav Hirsch used to describe the misuse of Kabbalah. There is no indication whatsoever, then, that Rav Hirsch rejected or denied transmundane aspect of Kabbalah. It may be revealing in this context to note that Dr. Isaac Breuer grandson and loyal disciple of Rupersh, introduces Kabbalistic concepts in his new Kuzari, notably the Sviros. Yet, Rabbi Danziger is so convinced of his own ideas about Kabbalah that he accuses such eminent Hirschian interpreters as Diane Grunfeld and Yaakov Rosenheim, and by implication Rav Schwab, who shared their views on this subject, of falsifying Rav Hirsch's teachings in the interests of ideological correctness. What about Rav Hirsch's preparatory notes for the Choreb drawn from the Zohar and the echoes and parallels of Kabbalistic literature in his works? Rabbi Danziger replies that they were put to use only in the kind of rational concepts we find in the Choreb. Yet these notes, as well as the echoes and parallels, are so clearly rooted in the essential transmundane substance of the Zohar, as mentioned above, that obviously Rav Hirsch could not have negated the latter. For another matter, if Rav Hirsch only drew upon Kabbalah for midrashic, metaphorical purposes, how do we understand his praise of Rambam's understanding of the spirit of Judaism, considering that the Rambam's whole approach was pervaded by Kabbalah? And finally, what about the Kabbalistic marginal notes in Rav Hirsch's Siddur, which Diane Grunfeld reported he himself saw? Can they reasonably be explained away as mere homiletic, inspirational ideas? In short, with all due respect to Rabbi Danziger, I do not believe that we are the ones misinterpreting Rav Hirsch's position. So let us see now Rabbi Shlomo Danziger's response to Rabbi Elias. With regard to Kabbalah, let us try to remain focused on the issue before us. What is being discussed, or what we should be discussing, is not Kabbalah per se, or Rabbi Elias's view of Kabbalah, or my view of Kabbalah, or Dr. Isaac Breuer's view, but Rav Hirsch's view of Kabbalah as it emerges from the text of his own words. Thus, unjustified are the words of Rabbi Elias that Rabbi Danziger puts forth his own idea on what Kabbalah is, which he seeks to read into Rav Hirsch's words. Nor in my review have I put forth or mentioned my own view of Kabbalah. Rabbi Elias continues, thus he equates Kabbalah and Agadah as merely being both, in his view, rhetorical and metaphorical works. The implication of he equates and both in his view are rhetorical and metaphorical works is that he and his view referred to Rabbi Danziger. I did not equate anything. I wrote that it is my understanding, based on Rav Hirsch's words, that Rav Hirsch did the equating. Thus I wrote, to Rav Hirsch, Kabbalah is an invaluable repository of the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud in the same sense as the Agadah contains that spirit. Both in his view, i.e., in Rav Hirsch's view, are rhetorical and metaphorical works. Rabbi Elias, again, the proper understanding of Kabbalah should have been ethical, not extra mundane. The whole sentence that I wrote was, his complaint is, meaning Rav Hirsch's complaint, is that the proper understanding of Kabbalah should have been ethical, not extra mundane. I was expressing my reading of Rav Hirsch's complaint, not my own view of Kabbalah, as has been implied. Now, to the substantive issue. Rabbi Elias argues that my reading of Rav Hirsch's attitude toward Kabbalah, according to which Rav Hirsch complains that Kabbalah should have been interpreted in human ethical terms rather than an extra mundane, theosophic sense of cosmic influence on worlds and anti-worlds, has never been put forth by any Torah authority of whatever camp. Even if this were so, it would simply be one more among other unique contributions that Rav Hirsch has made to Torah Hashkafa. As a matter of fact, however, Rav Hirsch was certainly familiar with the well-known Shelos Utshuvos Rivash, which weighs heavily in subsequent Psak Halacha, including the Shulchan Aruch. In Tshuva 157, we find the views about Kabbalah of 1. Rabbeinu Shimshon of Chinon, author of Sefer HaKrisos, whom the Rivash in his Tshuva called, this is Tshuva 157, greater than all others of his generation. 2. Rabbeinu Peretz HaKohen, colleague of the Ran and Rebbe of the Rivash. 3. Rabbeinu Nisim, the famous and illustrious Ran, also Rebbe of the Rivash. And 4. The Rivash himself, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Sheshas. All these towering Gedolei Olam had strong reservations about extra-mundane Sephardic Kabbalah. Thus the Rivash writes, I have already informed you that my Rebbe, the Ran, said to me explicitly that much too much did the Ramban commit himself to believe in that Kabbalah. Then he quotes a list of others who are also very critical of the Sefira understanding of Kabbalah. So continuing, Rav Hirsch, who has said, was certainly familiar with the Shelos Utshuvos Rivash, in which these reservations about extra-mundane Sefiratic Kabbalah are recorded, expressed his own reservations about these extra-mundane theosophic aspects in the way I understood the text of his words. By granting to Kabbalah its ethico-midrashic value in the spirit of Tanakh and Talmud, Rav Hirsch, while sharing with the enumerated Gedolei Olam his reservations about the extra-mundane theosophic, was overall more moderate in his attitude toward Kabbalah. When he writes about the extra-mundane interpretation of Kabbalah, Rav Hirsch uses terms A. External dream worlds, B. Magic mechanisms, C. Means of influencing theosophic worlds and anti-worlds, and D. Magical buildings of cosmic worlds. Rav Hirsch comments on Leviticus 7:38 that they, the Korbanos, are neither a concession to a generation that was still steeped in heathen ideas, which is Rambam's explanation as we pointed out before, nor do they form a chapter of Kabbalistic magic mysteries. Rabbi Elias informs us that the word Kabbalistic in this passage does not appear in the original German, which should be translated, and again we quoted it before, with that thaumaturgic, which meant magical, miracle-working magical mysteries. The word Kabbalistic does not appear, but the idea is the same. A magic mechanism, ergic, that has a supernatural influence and effect, thauma, on the phenomena of any part of the cosmos, i.e. a mystery rite. This is a characteristic feature of Kabbalah. It is magical, theosophic, thaumaturgic, and deals with magical mysteries by any other name, Kabbalistic. In his commentary, Rav Hirsch is rejecting both Maimodian and the mystical Kabbalistic interpretation of Korbanos. He is certainly not coming to reject only a mundane understanding of the mystical interpretation of Korbanos. Rabbi Elias' interpretation is that Rav Hirsch was objecting only to the popular anthropomorphic conception of extra-mundane realities taken in the literal mundane way. For this, Rav Hirsch did not have to raise his objection about external dream worlds or theosophic worlds and anti-worlds, for according to Rabbi Elias' interpretation, those external theosophic worlds and anti-worlds actually exist, but not in the mundane, gross way in which they are popularly taken. There are too many places in Rav Hirsch's writings where he stresses that Torah Judaism is rational, not mystical, concerned with human improvement, not knowledge of and effect on heavenly realms. Two brief examples. For this commandment is not beyond your understanding. It is not in heaven. And that's from Devarim 30, Psukim 11 through 12. On this, Rav Hirsch comments, it contains no secret metaphysical references to anything beyond the grasp of the ordinary human mind. The teachings and actions which it has in view do not move in the sphere of supernatural or the heavens. Another example from Collective Writings, Volume 1, page 212, for I, Hashem, have not come in order to reveal supernatural secrets that can be glimpsed only in feverish dreams, nor to bring a mystic faith to mankind. I, Hashem, speak forth righteousness. I proclaim the upright path. The contrast is always between the extra-mundane, otherworldly regions, and the human sphere of righteousness and upright service of God. With all due respect, in light of the foregoing, Rabbi Elias' interpretation is patently forced and unreasonable. Rabbi Elias cites Rav Hirsch's comment on Shemos 15:6 about God's right hand and left hand as a good example of how the ethical teachings of Rav Hirsch draws from Kabbalah are deeply rooted in its extra-mundane essence. Any objective reader who will take the time to look up Rav Hirsch's commentary there will not see what Rabbi Elias is trying to prove. The reader will see only that Rav Hirsch uses and reshapes Kabbalistic ideas to construct rational concepts that relate to the human sphere. Thus, his rational interpretation of the divine right hand and left hand is, God shows his real power and greatness, i.e. the right hand, in help and creation, in granting life and blessing, not in punishment and destruction. Punishment and destruction coming from him is itself only a means towards happiness and blessing. His left hand, i.e. punishment, is merely an adjunct in service to his right hand, i.e. blessing. This is a perfect example of how Rav Hirsch divests a Kabbalistic concept of what others take as extra-mundane entities and understands it rationally as relating to the human sphere, i.e., that all of God's providential acts, reward and punishment, are meant for our happiness and blessing. Man's happiness is the main divine purpose, i.e., the right hand, while punishment is merely an auxiliary adjunct, i.e., the left hand, to help accomplish that purpose. Rabbi Elias's citation from Tehillim 104:1, which I don't think we read earlier, is really the acid test that tells the whole story. You have clothed yourself with majesty and glory of might. Rav Hirsch comments, all of creation is your garment in which the majesty of your being and the glory of your might are revealed. And this comes from Tehillim 102:27. Rabbi Elias implies that Rav Hirsch was using the term garment in its usual Kabbalistic sense, but let us examine Psalms 102:27, to which Rav Hirsch refers us. They, i.e. heaven and earth, may perish, but you will endure, even when they are outworn like a garment. Rav Hirsch's comment that garment is a reference to the created, impermanent natural phenomena that declare the existence and power of their creator is classically Rambam. And even as you did exist before all else came to be, so you will endure, though all else perish. Your own existence is not subject to that of any other thing or force. And this comes straight out of Rambam's Yisodei HaTorah 1:1-3. Heaven and earth, all the universe are but your garment, i.e., they are merely the phenomena through which you reveal yourself. Heaven and earth, subject to change and decay, like a piece of clothing, can grow old and outworn like any garment. Rabbi Elias also cites Tehillim 145:5-6 that deal with Kivod Hodacha, the glory of your majesty. In his commentary, Rav Hirsch refers us to his commentary in Exodus 16:7. The brilliant way that Kivod Hashem is explained there leaves no doubt about what Rav Hirsch is offering is not mystical Kabbalism, but rational Rambam, pure and simple. It is well worth looking up. In a tactical departure from objective discussion, Rabbi Elias appeals to emotion and writes that Rabbi Danziger accuses such eminent Hirschian interpreters as Diane Grunfeld and Yaakov Rosenheim, and by implication Rav Schwab, who shared their views on the subject, of falsifying Rav Hirsch's teaching in the interest of ideological correctness. To say that a machlokas l'shem shemayim as ours, that one side is apologetic, is not the same as using the pejorative falsifying. One may sincerely believe it to be his religious duty to harmonize what are seemingly divergent statements of two authorities. This cannot and should not be labeled falsifying, nor impugning the eminence of those mentioned. Let me add that Reb Schwab and I discussed various fundamental issues over the years. We knew that our opinions sometimes differed, yet between us there was mutual regard and even affection. I should hope that the mutual regard that has hitherto prevailed between Rabbi Elias and myself will also continue despite this machlokas l'shem shamayim. Rabbi Elias urges overcoming fear of Kabbalah. We call upon him to overcome his fear of rationalism, Hirschian rationalism. This concludes the machlokas between Rabbis Danziger and Elias. And I would like to play one more thing here from Rabbi Wein, which you'll notice has some mistakes in it, but it relates to our discussion on Kabbalah and spirituality.
Hirsch, for instance, never mentions Kabbalah in all of his works. Hirsch also never speaks about what is today the most popular word in the Jewish world, spirituality. He doesn't talk about it. Because to him, to a certain extent, that's a cop-out. That means that you give up on v'nishma, you declare in advance that there's no v'nishma, and you somehow want to short circuit your way to God. Hirsch looked askance at Chassidus for that reason, because he felt that Chassidus was really a short circuit. It really, it's like you splice two wires together, and that for a period of time the lamp will burn. But after a period of time, if you splice two wires together and you don't really put it into a permanent combination, somehow then you'll get a short circuit. You'll blow the fuse. All sorts of things will happen. It is interesting to note, and I don't say this with any pejorative, because the Chassidim live in a different world, in a different society, amongst different goyim. It was just different. But the attrition rate amongst Chassidim to the secular world was enormous. Everybody that we see today here in Israel, the secular Ashkenazi Jews, so to speak, all had great-grandfathers that were religious. The Ben-Gurion records that his Zayde took him to the church of a Rebbe for a bracha. He remembers that yet. And they all ran away. Whereas in the Hirshian community, there was almost no attrition. Not fair to you to make a comparison. But the facts are those. So Hirsch was against this idea of spirituality because, again, he felt that it was an avoidance of the idea of the Nishma. We're not really going to understand God. We're not going to understand the Torah. We're trying to take shortcuts. Won't work.
So this concludes our discussion of Kabbalah vis-a-vis Rav Hirsch. And at this point, we will conclude letter 18, part number 2.